7. Intersections. 1. The day before the Essentash, the night market roused itself around noon. Apparently, the lure of festivities and foreigners eager to spend money was enough to amend the hours. With time to kill before the banner night, Lila wandered the stalls, her coins jingling in Elsor's pockets. She bought a cup of spiced tea and some kind of sweet bun and tried to make herself comfortable in her new persona. She didn't dare go back to the wandering road where she'd have to trade Elsor for Bard or else be recognized. Once the tournament began, it wouldn't matter. Identities would disappear behind personas. But today she needed to be seen, recognized, remembered. It wasn't hard. The stall owners were notorious gossips. All she had to do was strike up conversation as she shopped, drop a hint, a detail, once or twice a name, purposefully skirt the topic of the tournament, leave a parcel behind so someone trotted after her calling out, "Elsor! Master Elsor!" By the time she reached the palace edge of the market, the work was done, word weaving through the crowd. Stacion Elsor, one of the competitors, handsome fellow, too thin, never seen him before. What can he do? Guess we'll see. She felt their eyes on her as she shopped, caught the edges of their whispered conversation, and tried to smother her thief's instinct to shake the gaze and disappear. Not yet, she thought, as the sun finally began to sink. One thing was still missing.
Lila, said Calla when she entered. You're early.
You didn't set a time. The merchant stopped, taking in Lila's new appearance. How do I look? She asked, shoving her hands in Elsor's coat. Calla sighed.
Even less like a woman than usual.
She plucked the hat off Lila's head and turned it over in her hands.
This is not bad, said Calla before noticing Lila's shorn hair.
She took a piece between her fingers.
But what is this?
Lila shrugged.
I wanted to change.
Calla tutted, but she didn't prod. Instead, she disappeared through a curtain and emerged a moment later with a box. Inside was Lila's mask. She lifted it and staggered at the weight. The interior had been lined with dark metal, so cleanly made and shaped that it looked poured instead of hammered. Calla hadn't disposed of the leather demon mask, not entirely, but she'd taken it apart and made something new. The lines were clean, the angles sharp. Where simple black horns had once corkscrewed up over the head, now they curled back in an elegant way. The brow was sharper, jutting forward slightly like a visor, and the bottom of the mask, which had once ended on her cheekbones, now dipped lower at the sides, following the lines of her jaw. It was still a monster's face, but it was a new breed of demon. Lila slid the mask over her head. She was still wondering at the beautiful monstrous thing when Calla handed her something else. It was made of the same black leather and lined with the same dark metal, and it shaped a kind of crown or a smile, the sides taller than the center. Lila turned it over in her hands, wondering what it was for, until Calla retrieved it, swept around behind her, and fastened the plate around her throat.
"To keep your head on your shoulders," said the woman, who then proceeded to clasp the sides of the neck guard to small hidden hinges on the tapered sides of the mask. It was like a jaw, and when Lila looked at her reflection, she saw her features nested within the two halves of the monster's skull. She broke into a devilish grin, her teeth glinting within the mouth of the helmet. "You," said Lila, "are brilliant."
"Anesh," said Calla with a shrug,
though Lila could see that the merchant was proud. She had the sudden and peculiar urge to hug the woman, but she resisted.
The hinged jaw allowed her to raise the mask, which she did. The demon's head resting on top of her own like a crown, the jaw still circling her throat. "How do I look?" she asked.
"Strange," said Kala,
"and dangerous."
"Perfect."
Outside, the bells began to toll, and Lila's smile widened. It was time.
Kel crossed to the bed and examined the clothes, a set of black trousers and a high-collared black shirt, both trimmed with gold. On top of the shirt sat the gold pin Rai had given him for the royal reception. His coat waited, thrown over the back of a chair, but he left it there. It was a traveler's charm, and tonight he was confined to the palace. The clothes on the bed were Rai's choice, and they weren't simply a gift. They were a message. Tomorrow, you can be Kamarov. Tonight, you are Kel. Astra had appeared earlier, only to confiscate his mask on Rai's orders. Kel had been reluctant to relinquish it.
"You must be excited," Astra had said, reading his hesitation, "about the tournament. Don't imagine you get to test your mettle very often."
Kel frowned.
"This isn't a game," he'd said, perhaps too sternly. "It's about keeping the kingdom safe."
He felt a twinge of guilt as he watched Hastra go pale.
"I've sworn an oath to protect the royal family." "I'm sorry, then," said Kel ruefully, "that you're stuck protecting me."
"It's an honor, sir."
There was nothing in his tone but pure, simple truth.
"I would defend you with my life."
"Well," said Kel, surrendering Kamarov's mask, "I hope you never have to."
The young guard managed a small, embarrassed smile.
"Me too, sir."
Kel paced his room and tried to put tomorrow from his mind. First he had to survive tonight. A pitcher and a bowl sat on the sideboard, and Kel poured water into the basin and pressed his palms to the sides until it steamed. Once clean, he dressed in Rai's chosen attire, willing to humor his brother. It was the least he could do, though Kel wondered, as he slipped on the tunic, how long Rai would be calling in this payment. He could picture the prince a decade from now telling Kel to fetch him tea.
"Get it yourself," he would say,
and Rai would tut and answer,
"Remember Kamarov?"
Kel's evening clothes were tight, form-fitting in the style Rai favored, and made of a black fabric so fine it caught the light instead of swallowing it. The cut and fit forced him to stand at full height, erasing his usual slouch. He fastened the gold buttons, the cuffs and collar. Saints, how many clasps did it take to clothe a man? And lastly, the royal pin over his heart. Kel checked himself in his mirror and stiffened. Even with his fair skin and auburn hair, even with the black eye that shone like polished rock, Kel looked regal. He stared at his reflection for several long moments, mesmerized, before tearing his gaze away. He looked like a prince. Rai stood before the mirror, fastening the gleaming buttons of his tunic. Beyond the shuttered balcony, the sounds of celebration were rising off the cold night like steam. Carriages and laughter, footsteps and music. He was running late, and he knew it, but he couldn't seem to get his nerves under control, wrangle his fears. It was getting dark, and the darkness leaned against the palace and against him, the weight settling on his chest. He poured himself a drink, his third, and forced a smile at his reflection. Where was the prince who relished such festivities, who loved nothing better than to be the contagious joy at the center of the room? Dead, thought Rai dryly, before he could stop himself. And he was glad, not for the first time, that Kel could not read his mind as well as feel his pain. Luckily, other people still seemed to look at Rai and see what he'd been instead of what he was. He didn't know if that meant he was good at hiding the difference or that they weren't paying attention to begin with. Kel looked, and Rai was sure he saw the change, but he had the sense not to say anything. There was nothing to be said. Kel had given Rai a life, his life, and it wasn't his fault if Rye didn't like it as much as his own. He'd lost that one, forfeited by his own foolishness. He downed the drink, hoping it would render him in better spirits, but it dulled the world without ever touching his thoughts. He touched the gleaming buttons and adjusted his crown for the dozenth time, shivering as a gust of cold air brushed against his neck.
"I fear you haven't enough gold," came a voice from the balcony doors.
Rye stiffened.
"What are guards for," he said slowly, "when they let even pirates pass?"
The man took a step forward, and then another, silver on him ringing like muffled chimes.
"Privateer's the term these days."
Rye swallowed and turned to face Alucard Emery.
"As for the gold," he said evenly, "it is a fine balance. The more I wear, the more likely one is to try and rob me of it."
"Such a dilemma," said Alucard, stealing another stride. Rye took him in. He was dressed in clothes that had clearly never seen the sea. A dark blue suit, accented by a silver cloak, his rich brown hair groomed and threaded with gems to match. A single sapphire sparkled over his right eye, those eyes like night lilies caught in moonlight. He used to smell like them, too. Now he smelled like sea breeze and spice, and other things Rye could not place from lands he'd never seen.
"What brings a rogue like you to my chambers?" he asked.
"A rogue," Alucard rolled the word over his tongue. "Better a rogue than a bored royal." Rye felt Alucard's eyes wandering slowly, hungrily over him, and he blushed. The heat started in his face and spread down through his collar, his chest, beneath his shirt and belt. It was disconcerting. Rye might not have magic, but when it came to conquests, he was used to holding the power. Things happened at his whim and at his pleasure. Now he felt that power falter, slip. In all of Arnes, there was only one person capable of flustering the prince, of reducing him from a proud royal to a nervous youth, and that was Alucard Emery. Misfit, rogue, privateer, and royal. Removed from the throne by a stretch of tangled bloodlines, sure, but still, Alucard Emery could have had a crest and a place in court. Instead, he fled.
"You've come for the tournament," said Rye,
making small talk. Alucard pursed his lips at the attempt.
"Among other things."
Rye hesitated, unsure what to say next. With anyone else, he would have had a flirtatious retort. But standing there, a mere stride away from Alucard, he felt short of breath, let alone words. He turned away, fidgeting with his cuffs. He heard the chime of silver, and a moment later Alucard snaked an arm possessively around his shoulders and brought his lips to the prince's neck, just below his ear. Rye actually shivered.
"You are far too familiar with your prince," he warned.
"So you confess it, then?"
He brushed his lips against Rye's throat.
"That you are mine?"
He bit the lobe of Rye's ear, and the prince gasped, back arching. Alucard always did know what to say, what to do, to tilt the world beneath his feet. Rye turned to say something, but Alucard's mouth was already there on his. Hands tangled in hair, clutched at coats. They were a collision, spurred by the force of 3 years apart.
"You missed me," said Alucard.
It was not a question, but there was a confession in it, because everything about Alucard, the tension in his back, the ways his hips pressed into Rye's, the race of his heart and the tremor in his voice, said that the missing had been mutual.
"I'm a prince," said Rye, striving for composure. "I know how to keep myself entertained."
The sapphire glinted in Alucard's brow.
"I can be very entertaining.
He was already leaning in as he spoke, and Rye found himself closing the distance, but at the last moment Alucard tangled his fingers in Rye's hair and pulled his head back, exposing the prince's throat. He pressed his lips to the slope below Rye's jaw. Rye clenched his teeth, fighting back a groan, but his stillness must have betrayed him. He felt Alucard's smile against his skin. The man's fingers drifted to his tunic, deftly unbuttoning his collar so his kisses could continue downward, but Rye felt him hesitate at the sight of the scar over his heart.
"Someone has wounded you,"
he whispered into Rye's collarbone.
"Shall I make it better?"
Rye pulled Alucard's face back to his, desperate to draw his attention from the mark and the questions it might bring. He bit Alucard's lip and delighted in the small victory of the gasp it earned him as the bells rang out. The banner night. He was late. They were late. Alucard laughed softly, sadly. Rye closed his eyes and swallowed. "Sanct!" he cursed, hating the world that waited beyond his doors and his place in it. Alucard was already pulling away, and for an instant all Rye wanted to do was pull him back, hold fast, terrified that if he let go, Alucard would vanish again, not just from the room, but from London, from him, slip out into the night and the sea as he'd done 3 years before. Alucard must have seen the panic in his eyes because he turned back and drew Rye in and pressed his lips to Rye's one last time, a gentle, lingering kiss.
"Peace," he said, pulling slowly free. "I am not a ghost."
And then he smiled and smoothed his coat and turned away.
"Fix your crown, my prince," he called back as he reached the door. "It's crooked."